So we're now going to have the reading for this morning, which is Genesis chapter 7. The Lord then said to Noah, "Go into the ark, you and your whole family, because I have found you righteous in this generation. Take with you seven of every kind of clean animal, a male and its mate, and two of every kind of unclean animal, a male and its mate, and also seven of every kind of bird, male and female, to keep their various kinds alive throughout the earth. 7 days from now I will send rain on the earth for 40 days and 40 nights, and I will wipe from the face of the earth every living creature I have made." And Noah did all that the Lord commanded him. Noah was 600 years old when the floodwaters came on the earth, and Noah and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives entered the ark to escape the waters of the flood. Pairs of clean and unclean animals, of birds and all creatures that move along the ground, male and female, came to Noah and entered the ark, as God had commanded Noah. And after the 7 days, the flood waters came on the earth. In the 600th year of Noah's life, on the 17th day of the second month, on that day all the springs of the great deep burst forth, and the floodgates of the heavens were opened. And rain fell on the earth for 40 days and 40 nights. On that very day, Noah and his sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, together with his wife and the wives of his three sons, entered the ark. They had with them every wild animal according to its kind, or livestock according to their kinds, every creature that moves along the ground according to its kind, and every bird according to its kind, everything with wings. Pairs of all creatures that have the breath of life in them came to Noah and entered the ark. The animals going in were male and female of every living thing, as God had commanded Noah. Then the Lord shut him in. For 40 days the flood kept coming on the earth, and as the waters increased, they lifted the ark high above the earth. The waters rose and increased greatly on the earth, and the ark floated on the surface of the water. They rose greatly on the earth, and all the high mountains under the entire heavens were covered. The waters rose and covered the mountains to a depth of more than 20 feet. Every living thing that moved on the earth perished. Birds, livestock, wild animals, all the creatures that swarm over the earth, and all mankind. Everything on dry land that had the breath of life in its nostrils died. Every living thing on the face of the earth was wiped out, men and animals, and the creatures that move along the ground and the birds of the air were wiped from the earth. Only Noah was left, and those with him in the ark. The waters flooded the earth for 150 days. So it's thinking about Genesis, but also about some other stories. It's odd the kind of stories we're willing to tell our children. You can think of the plots of some well-known fairy tales. A woman lives with seven men, and she isn't married to any of them. Another woman does get married, but to the man who wakes her up after years of sleep after a curse. Another woman is a cannibal who gets burnt to death by one of her victims. A lazy young man becomes a serial burglar and eventually murders his target with the help of his mother, and so on. So those are the stories we tell to children. And you can think of films as well. That you get films where there's a deadly and terrifying threat that threatens the entire earth. And it kills everybody and almost everything on it. And hopefully, at the end, you get a few survivors ready to start a new civilization. So this could be the plot of a movie about zombies, about an unstoppable plague, or aliens. And it would probably be a 15 or 18 in the cinema. But you make it a flood, you throw in some cute animals and say, God did it. And we've got a story that almost every child in the church knows and loves. So, is the story of Noah a kid's story? Well, yes, in parts. There's lots about God's protection, about hope, about God's control, and we'll come back to that later. But actually, this is quite a dark story. If you dig beneath the surface, there's quite a lot more going on, and elements we don't really tell our kids about. So there's two particular ways in which this is true. The first one is this idea of the sea and the idea of flood. Now, if you think of sea for us, it's generally a very positive experience. On a beautiful summer's day, not a day like today, you go down to Hunstanton or Southwold, and it's there, it's beautiful, the sun's shining on it, you can go in it, you can play in it safely. Alternatively, it's something we go across in a boat or fly over to get to exciting foreign places. And in Britain, we have this idea of the sea as something that we know about. Britannia used to rule the waves, and we think we still do. So it's something that where we feel at home. But this isn't really entirely true. If you happen to go to the seaside in the winter, on a windy day, you'll see a very different sea. You'll see flood defences. You'll see the breakers coming right up onto the promenade, and in extreme weather, you'll see it coming inland and flooding places. And actually, that's more how Old Testament Israel saw the sea. They were really bad sailors in Israel. You hear about them going across the Sea of Galilee in Jesus' time. That's a large lake, and even that they found quite scary. But the Mediterranean, they were terrified of. It was big, it was dangerous, they got invaded from across it. Always a worry. And if you think about water in the creation story, you can see where this comes from. The very second verse in the Bible, Genesis 1:2, reads as follows. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And it's slightly complicated language, but basically what it's saying is that water is chaotic, it's unordered, and God needs to come and sort something out and do something about it. And in fact, that's pretty much the first thing he does in the creation story. He separates water from land, and he puts water up in the sky or right down below all the earth, so all this chaotic water can't cause any damage. Now, in the flood story, all this breaks down. God lets all the water back in. But it's not just water, it symbolizes chaos. And really what it's saying is that God is unraveling, allowing chaos, the creation to unravel. What God has put there, he's allowing to go backwards, so things return to chaos. And in fact, we're told this almost directly in the previous chapter. God says, I've basically had enough of this creation. It's evil. Man is damaging it. Everything on it is cursed. I need to do something about this, so let's flood it and start again. And this destruction leads to the second part of the story we don't really talk about. So when we tell the Noah story to children, we look at the 8 people on the ark and all the animals. We don't really talk about the millions of people who drowned to death. All the animals who drown, all the plants submerged. And unlike the way the story is often told, there really isn't a warning for these people. God says these people are evil, and he then blots them out. We often tell it as though Noah preaches to the people and they laugh at him, or they see Noah build the ark and they don't like it. Or even that Noah invites them on the ark and they don't come. But actually, this isn't in the story that we have here. And if you think about all these millions of people, they would have included people that Noah and his wives and his sons and their wives knew, they were related to, they worked alongside. So if you look at particularly the end of Genesis 7, and you think, what would have happened if the story ends there? You've got 8 people on an ark, they've been there 6 months into a flood, they're floating in a relatively small boat over quite choppy waters. They're confronted by one of their great cultural fears. There's no apparent progress, the water isn't going down. They might be mourning loved ones. It might look as though God might have abandoned them. And if you go into chapter 8, the first thing it says there is that God remembered Noah. There's a sense that God might have apparently forgotten Noah in chapter 7. So that's one way to look at the Noah story. The other way, I think, is to look at how it's used in the New Testament. And there's 2 references I want to refer to, which coincidentally are in 1 Peter chapter 3 and 2 Peter chapter 3, but they're completely different. So in 2 Peter chapter 3, the Noah story is told as a prequel to the end of the world. Peter says, you saw how God almost destroyed the world through a flood. Well, he's almost going to destroy the world in the end times. He's going to burn up all the evil stuff, and there's going to be a new heaven and a new earth. So what that's saying is, just as the first time God saw lots of evil, needed to do something about it, in the end times, there's going to be lots of evil in the world as well. God needs to do something about that as well. But there's a slightly more positive message in 1 Peter 3. And if you know 1 Peter well, you know this is the really cryptic passage where it talks about Jesus going down to the underworld and preaching to people in the time of Noah. But it ends talking about baptism. So what's baptism got to do with the flood? Well, they both involve lots of water. And just as the human race needed to go through the flood to be purified from all this evil, baptism symbolizes the way that we come to Christ. He washes away all the sin in our world when we're forgiven and become Christians, and we come out of that purified. So that's two different ways to look about the flood. It's involved lots of water, but it doesn't involve sin. It involves washing away things and a new start. So there's basically three messages which I think we can draw from Genesis chapter 7. And the first one is again, this new start. Sometimes God says it's time for the old to be washed away and a new start to come. And often, we have to admit, this is quite painful. But it's beneficial in the long run. So you can think of all the examples we have. We talked about conversion and baptism. Conversion and baptism is a very positive experience. It's a real blessing, but it's an experience we have to give something up. So we come to God. We say we want to follow you. God says, yes, you're welcome to follow me, but there's these things in your life that need to be dealt with. And they might be dealt with immediately, they might be dealt with over time, but conversion does involve giving something up. Again, you can think of the example of St. Paul. St. Paul, as Saul, persecuted the church. And you know the story, he was going off to Damascus to kill lots of Christians. God struck him blind and spoke to him and said, I am the Jesus who you're persecuting. And through that, Saul decides to follow him. He changes his name to Paul. He basically becomes the great missionary of the early church. He writes large chunks of the New Testament. So again, a very beneficial outcome, but quite a painful experience. I don't think Saul would have enjoyed being struck blind, being helpless, and initially having to rely on the Christians who he knew hated him to get him around. Another example quickly is the time of the exile in the Old Testament. Again, a time when Israel was meant to be following God, when it didn't. God had to say, okay, I'm taking away Israel, I'm sending you into exile. Some of them came back and formed a new, more stable country. A lot of them didn't. And the final example we looked at is the case of the end times. Again, we're told in Revelation there's going to be a lot of very, very difficult and dangerous and painful things happening. What exactly, we don't know. But we're warned that things will be unpleasant and there'll be suffering. We're told that God will go through it with us, and that when we get to in heaven will be wonderful. But we are told that things will be difficult. So the conclusion at this point is God's heart that all his people should be pure. It's God's heart that all his people should follow him. And God wants to help those obstacles be removed. But often, because sin and these things are so ingrained in us, it can be quite painful to take them out. So the second message we want to get out of Genesis, which is related, is that sin has consequences. So the question we have to ask is, if there's evil in the world and we don't let God deal with it, then what happens? Well, Genesis 6, which you looked at last week, gives you the message. God can't handle there being evil in his world. He made it perfect. That was the intention. He can't let it stay there because it damages the creation he knows and he loves. And Genesis 7 is one of the main examples of how he deals with it. Now, it's a one-off. We know that. We know he promised never to do it again. But it's an example of what God needs to do and what God is willing to do. to take away evil. And actually, the question of evil is a question which goes right through the Bible, particularly the Old Testament. If you look in many of the Psalms, if you pick a random Psalm, then probably one in three, one in four of them involves somebody complaining to God about evil in the world, saying, why are these people persecuting me? Why are people who do evil doing well when we're struggling? And the answer is pretty much always the same. God says, trust me, and I'll deal with it. But he doesn't actually say when he'll deal with it. He just promises that justice will be served in the end, that those who follow him will be rewarded, and those who don't follow him will suffer the consequences. And this can be over a short term, it can be over a medium term, it can be over the longest term of all. So the people in the time of Noah basically got their comeuppance at that time within 7 days. For people in our world, it may be later in their lives, it may not be until the time of final judgment. But I think there's two things we have to remember. If we, like many people in the Psalms, are feeling persecuted, if we're feeling downtrodden, if we feel that we're suffering from doing good, then there's definitely a future for us. One of the first things that God says to Noah is, I see you as righteous. And God sees us as righteous as well. Not because of anything we've done, but because Christ died for us. We're told that when God looks on us, he sees Christ's righteousness. So just as Noah was saved, then we'll be saved too. But there's actually a rather more challenging message on this as well. And that's for us to think about those that we know and we love who don't know God or who are turning away from God. And I think all of us in this church know such people. Personally, I come from a family where I didn't grow up in a Christian home. Most of my family aren't Christian. Most of my family shown absolutely no likelihood of becoming Christian, to be honest. I do pray for them. I do talk to them. But the pain in my life is seeing my parents getting older, and thinking, well, if they were to die tomorrow, then that would be it for them, and that's a painful reality of who they are. It's their choice, but it's one that we have a chance of influencing. And here we don't want to go quite so strongly down the message of Noah, I think. Again, we're told that's a one-off. Noah, in the case of Noah, everybody else rejects him. They're told there's no hope, and we know what happens. In our lives, there is a chance. The people around us have a chance of redemption. They have a chance of coming back to God. But we still need to remember them. We still need to pray for them. We still need to be a good influence on them and to tell them about God when we can. So that's two rather negative messages from the story. There's a third, more positive one, and that's that God knows what he's doing. God keeps his promises, but sometimes we have to wait for it. So here we've looked at Genesis 7 and the flood story and where it ends, though, on the water. But if we think of the entire story that we know from Genesis 6 to 9, we know how it ends. We know that God told Noah to build an ark. He says, if you do this, I will save you from the flood. And we know that Noah does get saved from the flood. We've looked at how God needs to deal with the corruption in the world. But we also know that God has plans for the righteous in the world, for Noah as well. But from the perspective of Genesis 7, things aren't so rosy. They're still on the ark, they're still in the waters. They're floating around, they've been there for 6 months. They may be running out of food and water. Things are probably getting a bit smelly. The boat may spring a leak. We know there's better things to come. They don't know this at that stage. And if we look back at our own life, we can see that pattern happening. Probably most of us have been through difficult times in our lives. We've been in situations where God told us to do something, or we felt God was taking us down a certain path. We did that. At least for part of it, it was fairly difficult, but we came out of it at the end. So in my case, I had a situation where about 4 years ago, I gave up my job. I felt quite strongly that God was calling me to do something different. So just as the recession was cutting in, I quit my job with no prospect of money coming after that. I had some ideas, but I had no certain income. But I felt very strongly that was God wanted to do. And things took rather longer to happen than I was expecting. So I ended up having basically almost no income for over a year, living off savings, living off a loan from friends. But through that, I was able to sort of gain lots of useful experience. I was a sort of chaplain at Adam Brooks, unpaid. I did some other work for the church, unpaid, and gained lots of experience. And through that, I've now got a much more worthwhile job where I'm serving God. So I've come through that, and I can see why that happened the way it did. But going through that, when I was actually beginning to worry about, okay, can I actually afford to keep a house? Can I afford to live? Can I afford to eat? It was really quite a painful experience. And probably other people here have been through similar experiences, or maybe that's where you are now, that you feel God is taking you down a dark path. You feel that he's promising at some point in the future there's hope, but you might not be seeing it right now. Now, I think we have to be honest here. God promises to always be faithful to us and be with us. God promises to bless us, but he doesn't promise perfection in this world. I think we know that from our experience. And I think for some people, either fortunately or unfortunately, what they're suffering now isn't going to stop in this world. You can think of people who are sort of terminally ill. You can think of people who are sort of suffering many other things. And barring a miracle, there's no real prospect of hope in this world. But there is hope in the next world. So God promises to bless us to some extent in this world, but more fully in the next. And it's actually worth reflecting on the end of the Noah story as well for this, for why this doesn't happen. We know that Noah and his family settled on this renewed, cleansed earth. But it doesn't take very long for things to go wrong again. I think it's actually in the same chapter where they settle on the earth that Noah gets drunk, and the cycle of sin starts up again. God doesn't promise an end to sin in this world, but he does promise an end to sin in the world to come. He promises through the rainbow that he's never going to sort of destroy the world in that way. And we know one of the ways that's been fulfilled is because he sent Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ is a salvation, he's a perfect salvation. And we know that if we follow Jesus, then we will have a perfect, eternal, peaceful future. But again, we have to wait for it. It will happen only when God decides it's time to send Jesus again. So what are we called to remember from Genesis chapter 7? I think the three things we've looked at. The first one is God has a heart for his people. God has a heart for his creation. And God is zealous that we should be as perfect and sinless as we can be. God has a heart for the people and the things that are affected by sin, for the people who are hurt, for the world we often don't treat very well. And God is willing to take whatever measures are necessary to get us to a perfect end. So in the time of Noah, there's purification by means of a flood, and that's a one-off. In our time, we have purification by God's salvation, and we have purification by God's Holy Spirit. And finally, we'll have purification in the end times. But we're also reminded that sin has consequences. And while we as Christians have this promise, those who don't follow God don't. And we do have an urgent call to those around us who don't know God to try and save them from what's coming. But finally, we need to remember that God has promises for us. God is with us in difficult times. And again, we may have to be patient. It all happens in God's time. God may have promised us things, but they may not come yet. And often, if things are challenging, we need to hold on and we need to have faith. And I think that's where the story ends at Genesis 7. Noah and his family are on that ark. They're holding on to this promise God has made to them. They don't know what's going to happen. They don't know that in 40 days they're going to be on dry land. We know the end of the story, so we can have faith. But in our lives, we don't know the end of our stories yet. And it may be that we need to hold on and have faith for the future. So we're going to close with two songs which explore aspects of this. And the first one is the fairly old hymn, O Love Which Wilt Not Let Me Go. And the reason I've chosen this, partly because it picks up some of the imagery. This talks about ocean depths. It talks about thinking about the rainbow. But it gives the other side of the story, going back to God's faithfulness. While in the Genesis story, we're called not to let go of God. We can trust God that his love won't let go of us.